Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello everyone and welcome once again to the Phantom Zone, your one-stop shop for all things nerdy. If you like what you hear today, you can listen to our other episodes on a whole range of nerdy topics now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and now on SoundCloud. My name is Chris Buick and I am thankfully joined once again by my friend and fellow nerd, been by my side for so many episodes recently, Toby. How are you, Toby?
Hello there. I am Mr. Reliable.
You are. I'm very glad you're here.
Do the podcast only, no one else.
No, he is. You're a complete flake in all our aspects of life. I mean, I doubt that's true at all. I feel like you are the stalwart of this part. You are the pillar that keeps us strong.
Yeah. I'd just like to hear myself talk later on when I listen to these back. So it's all just for my own benefit.
Yeah. You are a narcissist. You are just listening back. I mean, I don't know about you, but I hate listening to myself back. And I edit this podcast. It's awful.
It was very jarring to start with, but now I'm just like, oh dear, that was a very good joke, Toby.
I am so witty. It's weird because I've never really said this about the editing process, but obviously when you're editing, you can see like the voice tracks for everyone. So everyone's got one. So like everyone's very distinct. I know you guys very well by your voice tracks. So I can mine and Ian Spikes are a bit higher than everyone else's. You and Simone are a bit more softly, more assuredly spoken, whereas you're like, and another thing. And it just takes a spike up and I'm like, okay, so I just know I can just see signatures where people are speaking, and
it's cool.
We are getting together very shortly to record an episode live, see how that goes. So we'll look into that anyway. People don't care about this stuff, so let's move on to what people do care about. We are here this week to discuss the utterly phenomenal Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which hit cinemas last week. A very highly anticipated sequel to 2018's equally phenomenal Into the Spider-Verse. So in Into the Spider-Verse, so 5 years ago, we saw our main man, Miles Morales, be imbued with the powers of Spider-Man after being bitten by a radioactive spider, as you do. Having to harness his new powers while teaming up with alternate versions of himself who have entered his reality from other dimensions to put a stop to Kingpin's plans. There was a lot going on in that film. Yes. What it then did was open up the whole can of worms. So now, in Across the Spider-Verse, after reuniting with Gwen Stacy, Brooklyn's full-time friendly neighborhood Spider-Man is catapulted across the multiverse where he encounters even more Spider-People in the Spider-Society, all charged with protecting the multiverse's very existence. But when the heroes clash on how to handle a new threat, Miles finds himself pitted against the other Spider-Men and women and people, and must set out on his own to save those he loves most against all the odds. So I'm just going to get this out of the way now. Toby and I are going to be like two giddy schoolboys on a sugar high for the next hour or so. So we're not even going to try and be cool about this.
No, there's no subtlety here.
So we are fully in. So we're not even going to bother rating this at the end because there's no point. But we both absolutely love this one, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the first one had a huge bar set.
Yeah.
It was just, I mean, I've made it clear every single time, animation is just one of my favorite things of all time. And the first one Into the Spider-Verse was just such a treat.
Well,
out of nowhere.
Weirdly, you've managed to seamlessly segue into my first question for you, which was going to be in some kind of effort to structure this podcast for at least 5 minutes before we just go nuts. I wanted to ask you about the lead up to this film, because obviously part one, Into the Spider-Verse, had such an impact, and it came out of nowhere, because I don't think anyone was expecting what that was. Do you remember what it was like the first time you saw Into the Spider-Verse, and then, as a result, what that meant for your expectations for this film?
Well, it was, 2018?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were already, that was before.
In the before times.
In the before times, in the long, long ago. Before Infinity War?
Yes.
So I think that was, you know, it was a perfect time, because it was really sort of in that window where everyone was really excited about Infinity War, and this kind of just blew everyone's minds and blew everyone's socks off in the lead up to it, because we were just like, everyone was focused on Infinity War. We kind of thought, oh yeah, this new Spider-Man, maybe that'd be quite cool. But it, I mean, for me, I feel like this Into the Spider-Verse completely overshadowed Infinity War. I loved Infinity War, but it totally overshadowed it, because being an animation movie, being a Spider-Man movie to very high up rankings in my sort of viewership. And although saying that, I kind of felt that we were treading water with the Tom Holland movies. I think No Way, Far From Home and Homecoming and things like that were a little bit soft, although No Way Home, I'm getting lost on which ones they are now. Far From Home was the one with Gyllenhaal, and that came out after Endgame. So yeah, so the first Spider-Man movie, Homecoming, I felt that that really didn't hit for me. I felt like it was a watered-down Spider-Man, and Into the Spider-Verse was just everything I was wanting in a Spider-Man movie. And I'd read the Spider-Men comic books, which is loosely sort of inspired by, where Peter and Miles sort of meet up, and it's more based on Mysterio's actions, which I thought might lead into Far From Home, but it didn't really sort of culminate in that. I think they alluded to it, but I think they were leaving the multiverse for Into the Spider-Verse. And oh man, just the music, the score, the animation styles, the characters, everything just hit. It was just such a good movie. And then you've got this new Across the Spider-Verse, which has just been on the top of my list of films I wanted to see for the past 5 years. And God damn, did it deliver. It was amazing. So good.
Yeah, I think the very, very clear point now was, when this landed, we immediately were like, right. And we knew, and at that point, a sequel had already been kind of announced. We knew nothing about it, but we were like, whatever it is, put it in front of my eyeballs right now, because it was fantastic. And for me, the only expectation I had of this was the fact that I knew it was being made by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller.
Yeah.
He'd obviously done, 21 to Jump Street, which are great films, the Lego movie films, you know, even Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is, you know, an entertaining film, you know, so they had a track record. I was like, oh, taking on a Spider-Man film, and it's going to be out. I was like, what's this going to be? But so I was like, oh, well, at least it's in good hands. But at the same time, it's a Sony project, best one in the world. Their Spider-Man, Spider-Verse films haven't been anywhere near up to scratch as they should have been at that point. So I was like, okay, so you could see it kind of both ways, but my God, did they just go, nah, drop the mic, here you go. Film of the year that year. I agree, as much as Infinity War was a landmark, not just for the MCU, but in cinema, in superhero cinema, for what it meant as an actual superhero entity as a film, I think Spider-Verse really just upped it for that. And it just completely blew me away.
And everything was just so, like, everything just had so much depth to it. Like all the worlds, all the characters, everyone got a minute to shine, and they just upped the ante with Across the Spider-Verse. And everything just gets dialed up to 11. And I don't think that there's a beat that misses, really.
No.
So well executed.
And for me, because I'm actually not one of those people who would be like, when I see a film, will go out and actively try and get people to watch that film, because I don't like it when people do it to me for some reason. So I don't go, oh, but when I saw Spider-Man, I was just like, oh my God, you need to see this film.
Yeah.
And even people are like, I knew who would in no way probably even warm to it because they don't like superheroes or animation. I'd be like, no, seriously, it is genius. It's so good. But yeah, so obviously we waited 5 years patiently, or not so much if you're us. And now here we are. We have Across the Spider-Verse. We both saw it this weekend. How blown away were you? I mean, it's hard to put into words, right?
Oh, it's like you say, yeah, it is hard to put into words. I mean, it's more just like, oh my God! It was just a feast for the eyes. You know, as soon as... One of my favorite qualities of the first film was the intro with the approved by the Comic Codes Authority.
Yes.
And then they do it again. I was like, yes, we're right back at it. You know, they're not missing anything. And you get the phenomenal, quite a bold opening, starting with Gwen's backstory. Sort of jumping in straight to Miles, you know, because that's where I thought it was going to go. I thought Miles was going to do the recap and then we're going to move into the movie.
Yeah.
But they totally throw it left field by having a little mini recap by Gwen. And then you go into her backstory and it's the at least sort of the first 15, 20 minutes is her origin story and where she gets to in all the craziness in Across the Spider-Verse. And I think it's a really bold opening. And that was just a gorgeous sequence.
It is when you've brought in an audience from one character, Miles Morales, and then you don't start your sequel with that character. It can be a lot of people going, hold on, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Because I think even for me, there was a lot of that. I was like, oh, we're starting with Gwen. And it's obviously there's some fun elements to it, some action, but there's also a real depth to the emotional story she has with the relationship with her dad in that opening 20 minutes. And it's quite a long prologue, if that's what they call it, because it's only when the credits appeared, I was like, oh my God, we haven't even started. And a lot happens in that 20 minutes, but it's vital to... I think they made the right choice to do that in order to set up the premise of how this film will work in terms of how they navigate the multiverse, what Gwen's about, what she's been doing since Into the Spider-Verse. And when you've watched it and you get to that point where the opening credits start, you start to think, oh, actually, it was essential that we see why Gwen, where Gwen is first, before we can then see why Miles hasn't been in that. So what he's missing out on.
And whilst Miles is technically the lead of the film, it's kind of a split story of the two characters. You know, Gwen is every bit a central character, if not a secondary lead, as Miles is. You know, it's her story from her perspective leading into his narrative.
Yeah.
And it's how those two worlds meet and how those two sort of coalesce into how the overall film moves. Because it's realistically ball bearings of the film are very simple. You know, it's a very simple premise, but there's so many twists and turns and there's so much depth and character driven story in this. It just becomes so much broader as you move on through the film.
Yeah.
And as you progress, there's turning points that you kind of expect it to sort of take in a certain way, and they don't subvert that so much as I guess they do subvert it in a way, but they kind of tweak your expectations a little bit. And there's just a lot of bold choices. And I think just there's a lot of qualities where I feel that they're kind of answering to the naysayers about Miles as a character very much early on in his sort of foray when he was introduced as Spider-Man back in the day. And I mean, if Miles hasn't proved himself by now as being one of the tip-top Spider-Men in the universe out there, what more can you get out of this? It's so goddamn good.
Exactly. And I like as well, you're right, there's a lot of bold choices in this film, but when you actually step back to look at it all in retrospect as to, it really is... They're not just bold, they're very intelligent choices, and they're obviously there to tell the story in a unique way. For example, in the opening, when Gwen reveals to her dad that she is who she is, rejection of her from him, or rejection of who she's revealed herself to be, kind of sets us up to have it in the back of our minds that when Miles is trying to balance his his personal life and his superhero life.
Yeah.
You get a lot of people going, well, why don't you just tell your parents? I mean, they're your parents. Surely they understand. Well, that shows you in the first 20 minutes that it might not go that way.
Yeah.
So she is, to him, the warning that just because you think people might not be as accepting of you as you think. And that's a really interesting thing because, again, a lot of people will be like, oh, surely they would just be, you know, it wouldn't, how bad would it be if they knew? It's like, well, it could be bad. It could be really bad.
Yeah.
And it could ruin everything, which is where he gets that trepidation from. And I think no superhero films don't tend to go down that route. They just keep their identity for the sake of keeping their identity. And I think it's really done really well in that.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a very telling sentence in the film where Miles, I mean, I won't go too much into spoilers straight away, but sort of later on where there is a quality of where he's trying to come clean to his mother. And he says the line, "I didn't know whether or not you'd love me the same."
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And I'm sure that, I mean, people on maybe the gay actually would be able to tell you sort of more educated than I am. But I'm sure like superheroes in this secret identity, it's always a very strong metaphor for sort of the LGBTQ plus. And I'm sure there's so many sort of similarities in that sort of technical side of things where you've got this dual life. And I can see where the superhero quality can kind of relate to a lot of those people's because it's coming true with people in your life and it's accepting a part of you that you're keeping a secret.
Yeah, and this is me.
Yeah, and they love you for what they're seeing, but that might not really be who you are underneath. And so I there's a lot more depth to it and I can see where it can really sort of parallel in certain people's lives. And like I said, I'm sure there's far more educated people out there who can sort of go deeper into that. But I thought there's some very poignant lines like that where I don't know where if you'd love me the same. That's just quite a heavy line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, the film is obviously entertaining, looks gorgeous, is in every essence a Spider-Man film you'd want from a escapism superhero kind of film. Yeah. It has so many deep, well thought out themes running through it. Obviously the idea of identity and what that means, you know, obviously superheroism is the front of for this film, but ties into what you just said. Identity can mean many different things and being accepted for that. This film really allows room for that to breathe on for different characters and different perceptions of that. It's also got things about trust. So, you know, some of the characters having Peter's back, you know, having his parents trust that he is capable of looking after himself. That scene with his mother about, you know, she basically like lets him, sees him as starting to grow as a man and saying, you know, I'm not going to be there to look after you, but you need to look after you. And that kind of, you know, coming of age, trust kind of theme, and then obviously the bigger pieces like destiny, fate, what does this mean, you know, in your role in the universe, you know, really big questions, you know, for a Spider-Man film that in a relatively short space of time traverses not just very deeply and poignantly, but respectfully as well, I think.
I think it's a very clever story beat in the movie where you've got Miles' parents. So kind of the intro to Spot, and it's sort of the intro to Miles back into the movie, is where he's trying to get to his mum and dad at a school counselor's office. And that whole setting, as soon as he gets in there, it's the conversation about what's your story.
Yeah.
And whilst it's technically about him getting into college and what his story is for his application to get into college, it's really the metaphor for what's your story and what's your destiny in this.
Yeah.
Because the central theme to this narrative in terms of where the conflict lies, particularly with the Spider Society, is how destiny and fate is laid out for you and whether or not you go along with it and you accept it because it is written in stone, so to speak, or whether or not in Miles's case, you say to hell with that. That's not the way I do things. That might be how it's set in stone for you guys, but like he says, nah, I think I'm going to do my own thing.
Exactly. And I think as well with the, because he's basically told by Miguel O'Hara later on that his existence as Spider-Man is, you know, that version was a mistake because the spider that bit him wasn't meant to be in his universe. So he's basically being told that you are not meant to be who you are. And that is, again, a massive metaphor for, you know, people who have been, who get told every time that you are not, you're never going to be this person. You are not supposed to be this person. But like you said, Miles just goes, nah, I'm going to make my own choices.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make my own destiny, which really ties into the whole, I guess, is destiny or fate what you make it? Is it predetermined? Yeah. And the film really balances that well. And I guess lets us determine that as well, but also lets its characters determine it on their own terms. It's not a fixed answer for any of the characters because they all make their own choices, even though they all seem predestined to not.
Yeah, and it sets him apart from the rest. So whilst he's the anomaly, it kind of goes to show why he may be the anomaly, because he doesn't just go with the flow on that, and he sees a different route.
Hmm.
You know, he sees, I think it's kind of interesting because he was always a fan of Spider-Man before becoming Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So he's kind of got the idea in his mind that, well, this is what Spider-Man's supposed to be. You know, we can do both. We can save the day and we can save the people we love and we can have it all. Why shouldn't we? We're Spider-Man. We're superheroes. We should be able to do this. And, you know, I'm sure there's going to be some cost to that decision maybe down the line in Beyond Spider-Verse. We'll have to wait and see. But in terms of the here and now and in this story, you know, his message is very much like, no, I'm going to find my own way. I'm going to pave my own road. And it's such a great story. And it's so rewarding to watch this whole film transpire. The only negative is the fact that we have to wait 8-9 months to watch the next one.
I know. At least it's not 5 years.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, I immediately Googled. I was like, I'm pretty sure it's coming out next year, but I need to be sure. Beyond the Spider-Verse obviously comes out in March next year. Before we get into the lead into that and obviously where this film goes, I want to go back and talk a little bit about Spot, who you brought up before. Yeah. So obviously that whole sequence, the initial Spot sequence where he's in the bodega and, you know, in the deli and they're having the, you know, the quite comical fight of the ATM machine, and you know, he's, you know, in and out, he's, and Spot's not got complete control of his powers, and Spider-Man's Miles is, you know, trying to deal with the fact that this guy can just pop out of nowhere. But what I really like about the film is it takes a villain who's so clearly it almost seems like a fool, like a jester type character that, you know, is, when you have in Spider-Man films or Spider-Man games, you always have that villain at the start who's meant to introduce Spider-Man that he kind of webs up relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And then they move on to the bigger villain later on, etc. Yeah. Whereas
No, I was just going to say Spider-Man's whole roster is full of them. You've got the, as they say in the movie, the villain of the week, which is just the easy, you know, he's the hindrance on the way to doing something else in
like
the story.
Like Paul Giamatti's Rhino, for example.
Exactly.
The guy who gets like strung up in 5 minutes and then, but basically introduces us into the film, gets us settled, has a little bit of fun, action, etc. However, in this one, what I really loved is how they took Spot, who seems so ineffective and unthreatening, and made him into a real menace.
He's terrifying.
And obviously the art style really helps with this, which again we'll get into very shortly. But Spot and Jason Schwartzman, who I love, he's got a great voice and he's good at that kind of stuff.
He's second like foray into comic book villainy.
Yeah, exactly. And he, but the way they've just made Spot go, oh no, this guy, once he's figured out what he's about, he is bad news. And I really like how they subverted expectations for that, because I thought Spot wasn't going to be that big a deal, as big a deal as he was. I thought the multiverse would kind of collapse on its, but he's greatly written villain in this one.
And every time he upgrades, so to speak, Well, I tell you what, we really need to put spoiler warning at the title of this episode because we've just gone straight into it. Yeah. But the every time he upgrades, you know, it's the next feat that he starts doing. Because even after the first sort of upgrade where he gets the extra spots, just the way when they go to India on Mumbatan universe, and he's just toying with Miles, Gwen, and Praveet Papaka, and Hobie. You know, he's just toying with them the way he's just sort of like, you go away, pop in here, pop in there, and just snipping the spider webs as they get bound up to him. And then as soon as he goes into the collider, he's just a next level. Yeah. You know, he's a full multiversal threat, and you're just like, wow,
yeah,
that's an upgrade.
Yeah, it's a great character arc. He goes from villain who's had this unfortunate circumstance, just trying to get by, trying to rob an ATM in broad daylight, to a villain who's having fun with his new powers, and like you say, basically teasing all these superheroes because of how, and then full maniacal crazy guy. You know, he's gone completely 180, and basically it harnessed all his power, and you're like, wow, good God, this is a well thought out villain, and I really,
and it's all sort of initially done for laughs. Even with the villainous backstory, is like, I'm out for revenge. You know, you threw a bagel at me, and then the collider exploded, and I got caught in the crossfire, and it's all your fault, Spider-Man. And then you're like, oh yeah, sure, joke. And then upgrade, terrifying villain. Holy crap!
Yeah. Yeah, and again, it's back to another theme of, I guess, consequences, and there's choices. You know, things you do will have repercussions, and it happens across the world. And something Miguel O'Hara brings up as well is like, if we don't do this, if we make different choices, we'll have different consequences, and we need to follow a path. And it just shows you that in Miles's world, there were consequences to what he did in the first film. And, you know, I like that it has that kind of thought to follow through, say no. And something the MCU's done, I guess, previously is have consequences for the actions of its heroes. But I feel like this really managed to do that in a really nice condensed way in the time frame that it had.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that bit. I think I just picked up on the artwork here, so I think that's probably a good way to step in. I mean, oh my God, this film is gorgeous. It's
beautiful, beautiful.
It's absolutely gorgeous. But like every sort of storyline or character or event has its own unique look and feel. I don't feel like anything's ever recycled. Like you mentioned Mumbatan. It has, like, it feels so unique and fresh to anything else in the whole film. And there's characters within it, because they're all different, obviously. Hobie Brown, that kind of stuff. Spider-Punk. They all feel unique. What did you think of the art style in this one? I think they've upped their game since Into the Spider-Verse.
But I mean, the first one had just groundbreaking visuals, and this one just takes that and dials up to 11. Like, I think there's like six identifiable worlds that they've got, that have got basically each of the universes, each of the worlds that they go to, and each of the characters, they've all got a visual identity. You know, Gwen's world is very pastel, sort of watercolors, very soft edges. Even when the action's sort of going on, it's a lot softer. And you notice that tonal difference when Spider-Woman and Jessica Drew and Miguel O'Hara sort of jump in. And then particularly with the Vulture in that first Guggenheim section, you know, because if you sort of paint the brush, so to speak, and say that Gwen's world is more of a watercolors Monet type style, very soft, very pastel. And then you've got the very heavily influenced Leonardo da Vinci style with the Vulture sort of jumping in there.
Yeah.
Such a contrast of different visuals. And as they move on, you get Mumbatan. And again, it's sort of, it's a very harsh visual difference to what you've seen sort of prior. It's very harsh yellows, very harsh greens and blues. And everything stands out and is very distinct. And then you get Hobie jump in the middle of that with his Sex Pistols.
Yeah, it was like the clippings of a 70s punk magazine.
Exactly. Stuck together. And he stands out, and he more so than a lot of the other characters, he's almost got a silhouette around him where he shows how different and how, and it sort of really sticks to his character where he doesn't conform to the rest of the people around him.
Yeah.
So he really stands out against the crowd. And that, because, you know, he goes from shades of gray to color to this, that, and the other, very sort of aggressive sort of line work. And then you go into sort of the 2099 world with Miguel O'Hara, and everything seems very concept. You know, everything seems very, I mean, you've almost got the underbelly and the overground sort of worlds where everything above sort of sub-level looks pristine and sci-fi. And then you've got under sort of the subterranean world, which looks very much more like a Blade Runner-esque type thing. Mm-hmm. But something I thought that was really quite unique with Miguel O'Hara's world was that there's a lot of the characters, particularly Miguel, had almost like tracing lines where they looked more like they were rendered drawings.
Yeah.
So all of their edges seemed a little bit more rough. There was even sort of like the skeletal structured lines that went through his face and around his body. Very much like with a comic artist or an artist would sort of initially sketch out the skeleton of what they're drawing, and then you build upon that. So there was just so many little artistic touches throughout the film that just stood out and just felt so deliberate and just exquisitely done. It's so good. I can gush about this for hours.
Well, I agree with you. I think the Miguel O'Hara, it does look like, you know, rough sketches, you know, kind of, you know, a lot of angles, a lot of, you know, this is the framework of a character we're thinking of, and this is our base for him. But what it does is it gives him such an imposing presence and figure, which is his character in the film. Yeah. He is the man in charge, and he will not hear against his word in any way. And I feel like the way they portray him through the art style really accentuates. Obviously, he's huge and domineering and takes up the screen whenever he's in it. You know, you can imagine if he was in a graphic novel, he would be taking up a full panel all by himself, you know, and it gives them that kind of presence. And I think you're right, each character gets, Hobie, for example, does stand out, and it does complement his character in that he is so against everything else that's going on at all times, and that is his, you know, his aesthetic, but also his character in, you know, pure punk. But what I also love is how the film, for example, in the Gwen Stacy ones especially, are when the emotions change within a scene. So obviously the later scene with her dad when they're talking about her and her, I guess, secret life. Again, when we first see that and he kind of rejects her in the opening, there's very harsh red, angrier colors, and then it softens in the end and you can see it's all bleeding into like lighter pastel colors. And I think it's just really good at helping accentuate the emotion that those scenes are meant to be feeling, rather than just sticking with the colors throughout. And I think it just bleeds us. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's visual 101 in terms of like film and animation. Like, it's the age old saying of show don't tell. And I think that you could really, just from the visuals alone, you might not know the full ins and out of what's going on in terms of the conversations, but you could watch the film, I think, on like mute or silence, and you'd still get so much out of the narrative just from the visuals alone.
And
then you add in the dialogue, and all the voice cast just nail it. Everybody nails it.
It reminds me, I don't know if you ever watched Fantasia when you were younger. Me of that kind of thing. You know, when you watched it and there was no dialogue, there was nowhere. It was just art through film, obviously, with the, you know, like flowers blooming and stuff. But it would tell the colours and the palettes and all the stuff that was happening on screen would tell a story. I completely agree with you here that the aesthetics are telling, I guess, this sub layer of the story that's going through this kind of film. So even with Spot, when he's trying to figure out his dimension, he's sticking his, you know, head through different portals and stuff. It's all very frantic and jarring colors and shapes, and it's just really speaks to the, I guess, the chaotic nature of what he's going through at the minute. And I think they just go right. They've really thought about the whole visual as well as what we're hearing as well, just to really accentuate. And I can't, there's a lot of reviews I've read that have said, oh, maybe it's too much going on. I don't think so.
I think it's just enough. You know,
Yeah.
It all feeds into it because a lot of the spot, because you could almost do a blow by blow for each character and how their visual storytelling sort of denotes their part in the story. Like the spot, a lot of his backstory is black and white, and yeah. a lot of it's black and white, and it's very stark in how this is a vengeance tale, but it also, and kind of in how he discusses his place in the world, how he's always got this big hole in him, and the only thing that can fill up the gap is more holes. So it's just it kind of is the metaphor for the villain's life. You know, you just feel empty inside, and the more you do the evil, the more empty you feel inside. And it's literally I'm trying to get more holes to fill the hole, but all I'm becoming is just more evil and more just filled with holes. So I'm just becoming empty. I'm not resolving the problem. I'm just making it worse.
Yeah.
And then he just becomes the massive problem at the end of it. And I just think that the black and white portrayal of that is just so sort of in the moment of that character's arc, and it just epitomizes him. And I just think they do that throughout the whole film. You know, Miguel O'Hara, you get the little snippet of his origin story where he goes to another universe where his counterpart has passed away. So he thinks, oh, I can fill the gap.
Mm-hmm.
And that all looks all lovey-dovey and nice and bright and colorful. And then the harsh reality hits. It's very sort of dark and stark lines. And then everything becomes much darker, more jaded. And then he as a character just becomes very somber. And he's always very much lit in sort of dark colors, like dark reds, dark blues, dark greens, dark yellows. Everything is just shadow with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it just accentuates the characters. And I don't think that there's too much. I think it's all completely deliberate. And I think it's all just excellently well executed.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I think everything's really thought out to give this film its complete unique feel and really enhancing the story in every way it can, visually, audibly. The characters, the performances are fantastic. I'm looking at a picture of Miguel O'Hara now. And did you ever play The Wolf Among Us, the Telltale game?
Yeah. He looks very much like that character.
Very Telltale Games-esque kind of artwork there, which I really enjoyed because I always think those games looked great as well. But yeah, I remember, so as I've told you already before, but for the first time since I was probably, oh God, many, many years ago when I was very, very young, I actually sat in the front row for this film. And for the listeners who don't know, it's because the guy who sat next to me was playing music on his phone to the point where I asked him to stop and he wouldn't. So I got up and walked down to the front. So I was like, okay, well, I want to be as far away from everyone as possible. No one sits in the front row, but I had the time of my life hurting my neck, craning up, watching this film, looking at it, just mouth open for 2 hours, just smiling aghast with everything that was going on. It was incredible. Incredible film to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said to you when I saw it, I was in a cinema full of kids and I was a little bit worried that it was going to be the cliche kids making a lot of noise or getting upset or making just fussing around that distracts you. But now they were just completely transfixed and engrossed. And the only times I ever saw anything that could be classified as a disturbance is when the action was getting really hyped or just some visuals were going so hard that they just stood up from their seats because it's almost like they didn't have another emotional reaction to be able to deal with. They didn't have the emotional range to sort of process what they were seeing. So they just had to stand up in just amazement. And I was just like, yeah, I'm right there with you. Like,
yeah. This is,
I could have stood up and just clapped a lot of the way through this.
To be a young mind being molded by this kind of film is just...
Exactly.
Sounds amazing.
It's amazing to have it as an adult where you can kind of articulate your emotions around it. But even now, I'm finding it difficult to... I feel like the critique that we're giving almost deserve it is a bit of a disservice.
We're trying our best, but it's very...
It's so hard because it's...
So many emotions and thoughts.
I feel like this is more or less than a movie as it is just a culmination of an art project for all of those involved, you know, from the voice actors to the visual artists, the VFX artists, Daniel Pemberton, the music, the score is so good.
Mm-hmm.
The choices in soundtrack throughout the film are brilliant as well. Like everyone has their own distinct sound. Miguel O'Hara has a very sort of futuristic sort of sound effect. You know, Gwen's got a very sort of ethereal slash light theme tune opposed to sort of Miles, which is a lot more hard, a little bit more inspired by sort of like the urban music style of things. It just feels like one big shared art project, and everybody involved is getting A stars.
And I think if whether you're into Spider-Man or superhero films at all, you know, you even if you're not, you can look at this film. If you in any way appreciate the art of, I guess, filmmaking, I don't think you can help but look at this film and go, wow. I mean, across the board, everyone involved in making this piece of art, which is what it is essentially, is on top of their game, and they've all clearly got the same, you know, song sheet, and they're all singing from it, and it just really brings the film together. So as a piece, and it sounds like pretentious to say, but it is a piece of art. It really is. And there's a lot.
call me pretentious.
I don't mind when some people think about that.
I agree.
And there's not that many people.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I know that I've seen this film, because it's like I say, it's only been out a week, and you know, but those I've seen, I've gone, wow. I mean,
yeah,
even if they're not really into Spider-Man, still appreciate what this film is.
Yeah, I mean, I love Spider-Man as a character. I always have. He's my favorite Marvel superhero.
Agreed.
And frankly, Batman's my favorite superhero, but I'd say Spider-Man's a close second. You know, he's got the best rogues, he's got some of the best stories in comic book history, and he's just a character that, whilst you can't necessarily relate to sort of the spider aspect side of things, he's got a very believable and realistic type life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time he gets an up, there's like something that just crashes him back down to earth. You know, the old Parker luck, as they say in the comics. But
yeah,
and I feel that Miles Morales completely encapsulates what Spider-Man's supposed to be about in these movies. I think these films have catapulted his notoriety in sort of the comic book world far more than necessarily his comics have done. Because I don't think before Into the Spider-Verse, many people, maybe those who sort of touched upon the game, but that sort of come out around about the same time of the year. So the general public really didn't know a huge amount about Miles Morales.
Well, if we're talking about the PS4 or 5 game, Miles Morales, that came out in 2020. And I think, correct, we could be wrong, but I think a lot of they weren't making video games about Miles Morales before Into the Spider-Verse. They're certainly making them now, to the point where not only is he getting his own game, he is essentially co-starring in the new one coming up, where we're assuming, for you and I have theorized, that it will be switching between the two characters. So if you're looking at that analogy, Miles Morales has become kind of side by side with Peter Parker, who for years is who Spider-Man as an identity was only associated with, whereas what these films have done is really, and thankfully so, given Miles Morales the spotlight he needs, because he is a great character. And it says a lot when you're watching this film, you're invested in the home life and the emotional moments and his everyday stuff that he's struggling with as much as him fighting villains and teaming up with the rest of Spider-Man, because he's such an interesting character that has a different background to everything we've seen before, and credit to them for promoting that.
Yeah, and it's credit to the cast as well in terms of the family dynamic, because his dad and mum are very much more sort of, I mean, the dad was quite central in the last one, but his dad and mum are his mum probably more so in this one, are far more central to the sort of the undercurrent of what the themes are in terms of his place in the world and how he fits and how you've got this home dynamic that is pushing him, but they're kind of lost in the mix as well because they've got doubts about whether or not they're doing the right thing parenting. They're doing too much and they're not doing enough. Where does he sort of fit in? It's very mundane family life, but it's compelling to watch because each of the characters are giving it their all and there's an emotional depth and gravitas to each of their performances. Gush.
Well, let's get into some of the performances then. You know, in the last 15 minutes or so, we have to talk about this. So obviously, we've got quite a few returning voices from Into Spider-Verse, obviously Shameik Moore and Hayley Steinfeld as Miles and the Gwen. Obviously, they were really fantastic in Into the Spider-Verse. You know, we've gone over that film before, but I think what they do is their relationship takes a whole new level in this film. Yeah. And on that, the actors have to bring a whole nother level themselves to that too, in order to really cement, obviously, the relationship between them. Is, you know, what are they friends? What is the dynamic of the relationship? And I feel like they both play it beautifully. I think they're both really good in the role and really, you know, are in their characters, for lack of a better term.
And I think that they naturally mature them as well. I mean, it might come with voicing them for a second time round, and it might come with the story beats, but I feel like Miles definitely and Shameik Moore definitely adds more authority behind Miles's dialogue in this. And the same with Hayley Steinfeld. There's a more jaded, world-weary sort of undercurrent to her dialogue, particularly from sort of the opening monologue. And Shameik Moore all the way through, there's an uncertainty, but there's still sort of a more of a mature cockiness that comes with sort of those teenage years, where he feels more sort of sure of himself in his abilities and things, but still sort of has that undercurrent of doubt in terms of his place in the world. And I feel like Brian Terry, Henry as Jefferson, his dad, you know, sort of mirrors that as well. He's got the cop business down. You know, he's becoming a captain, but he's got the doubts as a dad and doesn't know what he's doing as a dad. Mm-hmm. And he sort of feels a bit lost in his world. And I really like the little dialogue between him and Spider-Man, Miles as Spider-Man.
Yeah, on the construction site.
Yeah, and he's like, maybe just, you know, let him spread his wings, man.
Yeah. And this film really gives you those moments of levity between the characters and, you know, real proper conversations between them. None of them feel like they're just there for filler or, you know, so that they can have a plot point where character A interacts with character B. I feel like everything, and it was similar to what I said before, everything here is thought out and is done for a reason. There's nothing there that's just thrown in to fill time or space or a scene. And those kind of scenes, like you just said, between obviously Miles and his dad, who doesn't know it's Miles, really kind of establishes that foundation of the relationship and the struggling, for lack of a better term, dynamic they're going through as Miles is embracing his new life, but and they want to keep him for his old life. And, you know, those beautiful. And then obviously, I think Lauren Velez, who plays Rio, his mum, has that unique moment under the water tower as well, where she kind of lets him go, but realizes, like I said before, he's getting older now, but she still unselfishly sees him as her little boy. And it's just a really touching scene, you know. And anyone, I'm sure, who's had in that kind of dynamic before can relate to that, you know. And it's just really thought out. So it's not just thinking of, oh, what can we do to make this a Spider-Man film? This is a Miles Morales movie at the same time.
Yeah. And it's very much like a conversation you've had with your parents before, where, you know, you're in trouble, but they kind of see the merit in you kind of living your life. So you're still in trouble, but go do this thing that you want to do. And then
just
come
be
back.
Careful.
And, be careful, come back, and you're still in trouble when you get home.
I
like that undercurrent, because even at the end where Rio tells Gwen, you know, go get my boy, but tell him when you find him that we love him, but 5 months.
5 months, yeah. Yeah, loves that bit. It's like, he's still, she's, after all said and done, she's still his mum. You know, exactly. you're still getting grounded when you get home. I don't care.
Yeah, and there's some great, yeah, there's great new cast as well, like Spider-Punk, like Daniel Kaluuya was brilliant throughout.
Yeah, he's really good. I think that character is brilliant.
Karen Soni is the Indian Spider-Man. I think he had some great standout lines.
Yeah, I love the very good when he says, I like chai tea. He goes, we're using chai tea. It's just chai.
Yeah. You say TT.
TT.
Yeah. And I'm just like, here's where the traffic is. Here's the next place where the traffic is. And here's where the British stole all of our stuff.
Yeah. That little joke there, I was going to bring it up. It's so quick, but it's so good.
He had some great lines in that.
He did. I think he really brought that character to life in a way that it could have been kind
just
of
a throwaway.
Throwaway, secondary, almost, you know, should we have had that character? He really made it land properly the way it should have done. Yeah. And I think they handled that really well. Daniel Kaluuya, like you say, really good as Spider-Punk, just completely anti-establishment all the time. Even cut of his own nose to spite his face kind of character. But
yeah.
But brilliant. Obviously, we've got Issa Rae as Spider-Woman, obviously, from the very beginning. She's great as, like, the, I guess, second in command to Miguel O'Hara. So, but kind of on the fence almost as to whether she's following Miguel or you can feel there's a real trepidation in what she's trying to, in where she stands on it all. But ultimately, she picks a side.
One thing I just wanted to touch on that, because it's interesting you say that about Spider-Woman or Jessica Drew, in how she there's a ambiguity, particularly at the end, where is she kind of sort of coming around to and there's that central, and it kind of rewards you in the sense for everybody, because there's some who sort of come around, and you can kind of tell with sort of Gwen and Peter B. Parker that they don't feel that this is right, but they understand the weight and the importance of the choices that need to be made for the greater good. Mm-hmm. But they don't want it to happen, and they're slowly sort of influenced by Miles's his decision to completely go against this. And that feels the undercurrent throughout the Spider Society, particularly sort of at the end at the chase climax, where sort of Miles ends up getting away, where everyone kind of feels a little bit more unsure of themselves, and Jessica Drew particularly sort of seems to be the antithesis of that at the end, because there's lots of little character sort of beats where I forget the spider character's name, the one who's using the VR, who's in charge of the go home machine. I think she's voiced by Sternberg, but
Margot Kiss, Spider-Man.
And she sort of seems like, what? Should I reboot this? No, because we let him get away. So that there's this, so it kind of makes them feel like, okay, so they're not really sort of going against their Spider-Man roots. They are still trying to do the good thing.
Yeah.
And they're kind of influenced by Miles, and that's great character development.
Yeah. And I really like the bit at the end with Jessica Drew, where, like you said, she's in I guess Matrix analogy, she's beginning to believe, you know, she's beginning to see that maybe this isn't the only way we need to do things, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe fate isn't feeding. We're going back to that theme again, you know, maybe things are written in the stars and they have to go a certain way. And we'll obviously see where that goes later on. But before we move on to, I guess, expectations for Beyond the Spider-Verse, let's Oscar Isaac as a performance. I think, I mean, Oscar Isaac is fantastic in pretty much everything, so it's no surprise to say he's fantastic here. But I feel like he gives a real menacing presence to a character, or a version of a character, that we normally associate with being, I guess, looking at Jake Johnson's Peter Parker, very opposite. Like, that's the Peter Parker we know, the happy-go-loving fun guy, and even he makes a joke going, you're supposed to have a sense of humor, we're all supposed to have a sense of humor, and he just doesn't.
You're the only one who doesn't have a sense of humor.
He is basically antithesis of Spider-Man in a way. He is not or Peter Parker, or, you know, any of the portrayals of Spider-Man.
He's more what you'd visualize as like a Batman.
He is a Batman-esque Spider-Man.
And
he's like, my way or the highway, as we said in our previous Dark Knight Returns episodes. go and listen to that as well. But yeah, he is more of a Batman-esque, and he is unforgiving and domineering and basically anything you wouldn't expect from a Spider-Man, right?
Yeah, very much ends justifies the means. And mm-hmm. like you get it from his world, it makes sense. He's experienced the true ramifications of what these canon events can mean if they're deviated from. So I guess it kind of comes from a sense of authority that he is the person to tell you what needs to be done because he's experienced it, whilst a lot of the others, if any of them, have not experienced that so much. So you can kind of see why he recognizes the importance so much and why he feels that he's got so much at stake, because it all comes from a good place. You know, he's the villain, quote unquote, or the anti-hero to this, or the antagonist, purely for the best intentions. You know, mm-hmm. he just doesn't want anybody else to have to experience the loss that he experienced. So it's not from a villainous or evil place. It's just he's desperate to make sure this doesn't happen again. And that in itself is a great sort of compelling arc, because it's not the typical, I just want to stop this because it's in control and I just want to make sure everything just follows orders. It's like, no, I just don't want anybody to experience the hardship that I had to experience.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
and I want everyone to be safe.
Yeah, it's important that he comes from an empathetic place, that you can see he has the best intentions, but he's not executing them in any way the best way, you know. And he's so hurt and broken from his experience that it's, you know, made him who he is. And I think there's a lot of, like you say, thought to make that character more as three-dimensional as possible and with many layers, so you don't just think, well, he's the antagonist here and that's it.
And you can understand why he's managed to get all the other Spider-Men on his terms. You know, because the intervention scene where he's going through the multiverse and then the web, the Spider-Verse side of things, where these canon events all connect all the universe and they are intrinsically important to the Spider-Man canon, mm-hmm. and how each of them sort of feed into the multiverse. And so you can kind of see through that story, and just excellently well executed cameos and references to the other universes, mm-hmm. that frankly I feel handle it in terms of the multiverse a hell of a lot better than the MCU have been doing thus far. You can see where he's managed to get all these other Spider-Men on board, so it's not like, okay, well, they've all been sipping the same Kool-Aid because he's just a very clever villain. It's no, he's just he's hitting all the right notes with them.
Yeah.
They've all experienced this loss in some way or another, and it justifies why that loss was important. So it's a more compelling reason why you've experienced this loss. It's important for a reason, because this matters to the multiverse. Your existence, your hardship has mattered to the universe. So you can kind of see why everybody gets on board with it.
Yeah.
And Miles sort of deviating from that does risk everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And then you need us to believe why they would follow him and why all the other Spider-Men wouldn't just help Miles, you know. And I think that's important. But and I think Oscar Isaac plays it tremendously well, as you would expect from an actor of his caliber, because he is incredible and very handsome as well. Ridiculously
he is indeed.
But I also want to give a shout out, on a serious note, first of all, to Shea Whigham as George Stacy as Gwen's dad, because I feel like the two big scenes between them that we've already spoken about are really, as a two-part, are really done beautifully well. And I think if there's a real core emotion for me in this film, it's between those two, about acceptance and, you know, things he's given up at the end for her, because he'd rather, because you think, he basically tries to arrest her in the beginning, and then basically he comes and says, no, you are my daughter, and that's the important thing. And that whole moment, it's just beautiful, that moment. And I think the two both play well. And then on a less serious note, I think Andy Samberg as Ben Reilly's Scarlet Spider, who's just so completely ridiculous over the top, as you would expect from Andy Samberg. But I think it was genius. He's just so ridiculously dramatic as Peter Parker, but played really well. And there's tons of other great cameos throughout this, which a lot of them are named. A lot of them are named. There's probably about 40 in here that you would never know who they were. The Spider Horse guy. Why is he wearing masks to protect his identity?
Yeah. And even the villain cameos, I think, were one of the highlights, particularly with Donald Glover as
Donald
the
Glover, live action Donald Glover as the Prowler.
That was so good. I was so
Childish Gambino.
I mean, that was one of the moments where I could have very much been like the kids in the audience and stood up from my seat. I was like, "Oh my god, it's Donald Glover! It's so good because it hits on so many different levels." You know, he's been a huge Spider-Man fan ever since he was younger. You know, he apparently, according to Brian Michael Bendis, is one of the influences as to why Miles Morales even exists, because he was influenced by Donald Glover. Donald Glover was in Homecoming as Aaron Johnson, as a blink and you'll miss it sort of cameo.
Yeah.
And now he's finally been recognized as the Prowler in real life. And I kind of hope this is just a touch on where he may be going further on down the line. I'd love to see him portray a proper Prowler in the live action Miles Morales movie that has been heavily intimated.
Yeah, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. I would watch that. I think, I think Donald Glover has the right kind of charisma to carry that kind of film out. I think it's been rumored before about Donald Glover reprising that role and other things, so it's not completely beyond the realms. It might have been just an allusion to this film. It is a very great cameo, to be fair. And I think there's a lot of really fun little moments and either funny or just brilliant references to obviously the lore and other Spider-Man things that we've seen. For me, for example, when it goes to the Lego universe, it's a massive thing. Obviously, I'm a massive Lego fan, and Lord and Miller being, you know, of the directors of the Lego movie, probably didn't have to make too many calls to make that work. You know, they probably said, "Hey, we need a favor," and brought it in. And then obviously you've got J.K. Simmons as well, who returns with his voice, because I mean no one else can voice J. Jonah Jameson as long as he's
there. I was gonna say, is he must be the universal constant.
I feel like he's just contracted by everyone.
No matter what universe he is, or no matter what movie depiction of J. Jonah Jameson, it has to be J.K. Simmons.
And I'm fine with that. As long as he's around, just keep doing it. There's no one else. He's always been he'll always be J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah.
Love that bit. What are the moments for you really stood out?
Oh, there's so many. I mean,
obviously the meme bit where they're all pointing at each other.
Yeah.
It's great.
I mean, the Spider Society bit you could pick out because of all the little Easter eggs. There's so many Easter eggs in this movie. There's a little section where Miles and Gwen are going to go see Miguel O'Hara for the first time, and Hobie is breaking bits off. And right behind them as they're walking through, you can see the 2099 white spider suit being built.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a little tease for the next movie where he's going to get maybe a suit upgrade. But I mean, there's so many highlights to this. It's crazy. But in terms of an action set piece that was really inspirational and it kind of led into how I feel Miles has progressed as a character, is the Mumbatan scene where Alchemex has sort of collapsing in on itself and it's sliding down towards the rest of Mumbatan. And he's the one that takes lead. He gives everyone the instructions. He's the first one to sort of jump into action. And everybody just follows suit. Even Hobie, you know, being like, I'm not doing it because you told me to. I'm doing it because I need to be doing it.
Yeah.
But it's just like, that's Miles, man. He's just taking charge. He's coming into his own as a superhero. Mm-hmm. He's coming into his own as Spider-Man. And that set piece was just fantastic. And it was really sort of rewarding to see like all the the civilians start sort of applauding and clapping them, because it's like, yes, you know, that was earned, that was deserved, and that was such a visual stamp, like just groundbreaking scene where him and Indian Spider-Man are sort of saving the civilians going around, and then Gwen and Hobie sort of stopping the building from coming down.
Yeah,
just a phenomenal set piece. That was one of my huge set sort of standout moments. And then sort of just the character drama throughout. I thought there was a really great scene with Gwen and Miles on the clock tower after they haven't seen each other for ages. And there's that sort of will they, won't they sort of moment where you know, they're saying, oh, you know, I've heard that every Gwen that gets with a Peter Parker or a Spider-Man or a Miles Morales in another universe.
That's true. Just ask Emma Stone.
Yeah, it doesn't end well. Saying it's a sticky situation. And again, Miles is sort of like, well, there's a first time for everything.
But again, just, going back to that idea of is fate predetermined, you know? Exactly. So, you know.
And it's just that course throughout the movie about fate and all this sort of things. And their relationship that, if I'm going to ship one, I think it's great. I really like the dynamic between the two of them, and I think they really complement each other.
Yeah.
And I just think the Shameik Moore and Hayley Steinfeld really just play off well with each other. And I think that those scenes that they have together, where there's a little bit more thoughtfulness behind the narrative and behind the conversation, you can sort of feel the emotional weight behind it.
Yeah, agreed. I think I'm with you. I'm shipping it. So, you know, I'm happy to see that dynamic blossom. If, you know, if it's going to happen, I'm fine with it. I don't think it'll be as obvious as, you know, some relationship ending or some, you know, relationships develop into that kind of thing towards the end of a story. I think it'll be a bit more subtle. But you'll just know that that's where they're at rather than being told and shown. You know,
yeah,
egregiously, that's where they're at, which I think is part of the strength of this film. It doesn't need to be so on the nose with anything. It doesn't top down to its audience. It doesn't try and, you know, make it super, you know, simple for everyone to just kind of get on board. They just go, this is the film we're making, and, you know, and that's it. And it's a fantastic film. I really like, for me, I guess the other moment I realized was actually towards the end when Miles realizes he's not back in his home world, but his uncle is there, and then realizing that actually he is the Prowler in his actual world where the spider is from, essentially. Yeah. And I feel like that whole scene, with the tension, the build up between, like, okay, is his uncle still the Prowler in this world? What's happening? What's the situation? Because it doesn't give a lot away. And then that reveal, I just think it's so well done. The tension is brilliant. And it really serves the film to go, right, this is where we're going to stop now. See you in 9 months. And you're like, no, come back.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you, because I knew the to be continued was coming.
Yeah.
I knew it was coming, but I just kept telling myself, nah. There's going to be like another 20 minutes, another 30 minutes, because I know we've hit home number of times on the podcast about how we like a shorter movie. I did not notice a minute this going.
No, I didn't. It was only towards the end, because I was like, I know how long this runs and I know what time it is. I was like, hold on. And then I did my I forgot there's Beyond the Spider-Verse, which we'll get into in a sec, was originally called Across the Spider-Verse Part 2. So,
yeah,
we knew that going in, but at the same time, it still cuts and you're like, oh my God, no, come back.
Yeah, I knew it was coming and I was just like, nah.
How much money do you want? I'll give you that.
I just kept convincing myself it wasn't coming, it was coming later. And I was like, nah, we're earlier in the movie than I thought, you know, but nope, the TV continued hit. And you're right, the tension in that, I knew what was coming because I recognized that it scanned the spider, the 42, World 42. So I was like, okay, so he's gone to the wrong universe. I recognized that, but still that, like you say, the reveal and the tension in that was so well done. Because you get the happy-go-lucky sort of mum side of things where you're like, oh, yeah, well, maybe I'm wrong. And then Uncle Aaron sort of walks through and you're like, oh, man, oh, no, okay, okay. And then, like you say, the reveal with Miles being the Prowler at the end was so well done. And if there's not two totally different versions of Miles, you know, the Spider-Man version of the Prowler being far more sinister, far more... well, just sinister, really, just being really sort of unsettling, hanging from the rafters, really sort of encapsulating what the Prowler was in his universe before.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that was really well executed.
I like I say, it puts such a good button on part one to obviously not only leave you wanting more, but realize that there's a lot more to come. There's a lot of stakes that are going on, not just with, you know, the multiverse, but Miles' own, you know, stuff that he needs to deal with, you know, and not only himself, but, you know, a version of himself that is not what he would expect to ever turn out to be. And it just like opens up more doors and more stuff rather than just closing a bunch before we leave for part one. So,
yeah. And it's really quite interesting because the more we talk about it, the more I've sort of realized that there's a lot that sort of carries over from one into this one. Whilst a lot of sequels, they kind of, once they've got past the introduction side of things, they kind of drop a lot of that.
Yeah.
And then let the second one become its own piece. And whilst that one does this, it takes a lot of what it brought with it from the first one. You know, Aaron is not a character that's just forgotten. He was the emotional weight for that movie. And then we've moved on. Hmm. He's sort of a through line throughout this. And everything that sort of happened has had ramifications moving into the second one. Like the whole set piece is because of the Collider incident that happened because of the Kingpin. And all that has led into this one. And it just feels like a natural story progression.
Yeah.
It then feeds into being more of a complete trilogy because everything sort of feeds in from the first one.
Yeah, rather than it being two films, we basically go, no, it's the same film. We just made you wait 5 years to watch the rest of it. And, you know, that kind of vibe. And then we're going to make you wait another 9 months to watch the last 2 hours. It's a 6 hour film, but we're going to split it up for you. And it does feel like one big narrative because you're right, in sequels, you'll get, you know, they'll have the events that unfold in part one, which are then generally forgotten about. And she's like, oh, well, the character must completely be over it. But Miles isn't over what happened to his uncle, obviously, in no way or form. He's just dealing with extra stuff. You know, he's still got all that baggage. He's just got more to deal with. And it doesn't go away, much like in real life, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I really like how to do that. I'm really excited to see how they progress this into Beyond the Spider-Verse. I mean, we are March, April 2024.
March, I think, yeah.
March 2024. So we are, you know, 9 months away from that glorious time where we can come back and talk about that. But I guess a couple of quick fire questions for you before we wrap up. So best version of Spider-Man? Pick one.
Well, I mean, if we're going just by the movie, I'd say Miles. But I got to say, I've always got a soft spot for the Insomniac Spider-Man. So it was really nice to see him pop up. And there's two hot questions. There's so many. I love them.
There's a bit where Genki's playing video games in his room. And he's playing it. It's really good. I like that.
Yeah. That's such a hard question. Because there's so many. Because I actually used to be a huge Ben Reilly fan.
Yeah.
I used to love Scarlet Spider. So seeing him being in this, he's kind of a joke character, but it's great to see him. Because he is really angsty in the comics. Because he's dealing with all the ramifications of being the clone of Peter Parker. So there is that angst. And I just think that they really, like you say with Adam Sandberg, they really nail that. And I think that's really comedic. It was great seeing Spectacular Spider-Man getting some representation. Because I think a few of the creators on that work on this movie. So it's good to see some representation there. Oh god, there's too many in this. It's so great.
You had the Spider-Man from the old school PlayStation 2000 Neversoft Spider-Man was in there as well.
Yeah, and even the Steve Ditko Spider-Man where he's like, anything you could do, I could do too. I pulled something. That's such a brilliant minute.
Really good. Obviously, I think if I'm gonna try and stick myself to someone, I'm going to try and limit to the main, I guess, canon, and probably say that Hobie was just such a breath of fresh air amongst the rest of the Spider-Man, and Kalea's portrayal of him was really good, and it's just basically just because I feel I always like a bit of punk rock myself, so I'm all for that kind of attitude when it comes to these things. So I was like, you're just doing your own thing, man, and all this stuff, and he is more of a catalyst than we realize as well.
Yeah. Well, I think if we can do it by that, then if we're going to do it by the central cast, I'm going to say Miguel O'Hara 2099, just because I'm a 90s angsty boy just as much as he was. You know, I can envision him listening to new metal, some Linkin Park.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to get right on there with my boy Miguel. Of the main cast, him and probably Gwen stood out for me because I think Gwen really came into her own in this one.
Yeah, I agree. I think Gwen Stacy, Hayley Steinfeld's performance is top-notch, 100%. Obviously, she's a great actress ever since I remember seeing her in True Grit all those years ago.
Yeah.
For the first time, and thinking, wow, she's really talented. But
She's got a great agent.
Yeah, I know. Well done, that agent. You've earned your money. You've earned your commission. But she's... And we said this before about voice acting, how it's a different talent, you know? You don't have the appearance for expression that can help. So to get across as much emotion and impact into a character as you, purely through vocals, really speaks to talent, and she's got that in spades.
Well, have you ever seen, because this is not her first voice acting gig, she's done a fantastic TV show on Netflix called Arcane.
Yes,
which is another animation trip.
God, yeah.
That's like a love letter to Into the Spider-Verse. You know, that I feel like that was heavily inspired by what they sort of did and breakthrough in animation for that, and that sort of feeds into it. So it's a beautiful love letter to that animation style whilst creating its own world. So if you haven't seen that, see that. That's amazing. Arcane on Netflix.
Arcane is great. People should see Arcane for sure, especially if you love animation and anything like that. I feel like Hayley Steinfeld's just one of those actors that when they're in a movie, you're like, okay, I have faith in this.
She just sort of it's like the golden touch, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's not many that can have that kind of effect, but she is, I feel, one of them. So I guess last question, part one or part two? Into the Spider-Verse or Across the Spider-Verse?
Oh man.
There is no wrong answers here.
These are the hard-hitting questions. I would say that part two is really fresh in my mind. I'm going to say part two because I just think they up the ante so much. But part one, you can't have part two without part one.
Of course.
And they are all kind of the one story, as we just sort of alluded to, how it's all one big narrative. But I feel like everything that was sort of brought on in the first one was just exemplified and amplified in this one. So I think that whilst it had the benefit of having the platform to sort of build upon, this one has executed it even better. So I would say part two.
I would agree. However, I would also agree that, you know, I'll take either. You know,
any day of the week.
You put either on, I'm going to watch it and I'm going to have a great time. I think you're right. Part one and part two go hand in hand. I think two, yes, of course, it is fresh in our minds and we are, you know, it's for less than a week out from watching it, you know, and
we're on that spider high.
We're on the spider high and we've been bitten by radioactive fun. I think when you think about how sequels normally go, obviously they always go bigger, but not always better. This is bigger, better, bolder, all the bees. And basically just
get your alliteration out there.
Just any of those words. But obviously a lot of that comes from the good work that Into the Spider-Verse does. And if this trajectory is to be continued, that means Beyond the Spider-Verse is just going to blow our tiny minds.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I can't wait for March. We will obviously be back next March to talk about Beyond the Spider-Verse. Can't wait for that. Put it in your calendars. I think as much as we probably could go on about this for another 4 hours or whatever, I think that's all the time we have this week, Toby, I'm afraid, for our Spider-Verse chat. Unfortunately, we couldn't be joined by Ian and Simone this week. You know, life gets in the way and, you know, we're trying to...
Goddamn life. Goddamn life.
God, just get... But we will be meeting up with them again soon. We do plan on all getting together for the first time to record live after watching the upcoming Flash movie in a couple of weeks, which we're very excited about, which is, again, not something we thought we'd say when we first heard about it, but here we are.
Bob.
The hype is real now.
It is indeed.
But we do hope that we can get at least Ian and Simone's thoughts on Spider-Verse next time we speak to them as well. So we maybe even release that as a little bonus snippet for you guys to listen to. But until then, obviously, thank you to UK Film Review, who we are in partnership this week. They are always very supportive and we love working with them. And Chris is fantastic. Thank you, Chris. If you want to check out our show and our episodes on there, you can. UK Film Review also has other great shows. There's The Scream Test, hosted by Rachel, that all things horror. She's great to listen to. We've got the Gay Actually Girls, Amber and Joyce, who talk about all things LGBTQ+, which is very pertinent right now, being it's Pride Month. Happy Pride Month, everybody.
Happy Pride Month.
Yeah, it's a great month. I love Pride Month. Full of good vibes. So check out their podcast as well. You'll have a great time listening to them. You can listen to us as well on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud, and a whole range of nerdy things. What do we talk about, Toby? Batman, Marvel, Star Wars, Last of Us. What else have we? So much stuff, right?
Everything. Everything nerdy. Anything, everything. Anything nerdy.
And everything everywhere.
All at once. And we will all talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, we will. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can at the Phantom Zone Podcast on Instagram. You can email us at the Phantom Zone Podcast @gmail.com. Please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Any suggestions, any messages, which we've had a few kind words, which is very nice. So we do appreciate that. But mostly, thank you for listening. We do appreciate you joining us every week. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.